So there have been a fair number of messages on trust today. I woke this morning and did a little bit of reading, and no surprise to me. Well, I guess maybe a bit of a surprise to me was a scripture on "Do not worry." I didn't know that the Bible verse for this month was "Trust the Lord," and I don't have any of those scriptures in my sermon. And there's a part of me that goes, "Oh my gosh, I should have had that there. Why didn't I have that there?" But I didn't. You'll get a different sermon. Well, maybe a same sermon, but a different set of verses. Last week, Gary preached on Psalm 23 with the picture of God as our good shepherd, and how we look to our past to determine who we are, and how we look to him to determine who we really are. When we discover the truth of who we are and who he is, we discover that we're all invited to a party with the host of the Lord of hosts. The power of the enemy is gone, and there's nothing to worry about today or tomorrow, because our good shepherd has protected us from the wolves that have tried to draw out the weak. But do you believe that? Do you really believe that? Do you trust him? Does he have us, or doesn't he? Or is it that you don't trust the shepherd? Maybe you're a sheep that is looking for greener pastures. Maybe you're straying from the good shepherd. Maybe you're ignoring the shepherd and you're getting taken out by the wolves because you're not part of the herd, because you think you have a better plan than he does. Probably because you're trying to control something, because you don't trust him. Or maybe trusting is about something completely different. Which one am I? Which one are you? I don't know. Nothing seems to test our trust like when we aren't in control, and a wicked one is, though. Maybe that's the point. You know, Steve asked me to consider preaching. We were talking about Psalms, and I started rattling off this story about my work, and I thought I was actually going to tell you guys about that story and about how a wicked man prospered, but I discovered in the midst of doing this sermon that actually wasn't the point. The point wasn't about the wicked man. The point is actually about trusting God. Now, Gary and my friend Tim here, they walked beside me through that story. Dang, happened already. I was wondering how long it would take until I get emotional here. Happened sooner than I expected. A warning to you, if you ever decide that you're going to preach, Steve might not tell you the whole truth about things. He said that it would be really quiet in here today because it's summertime, and, you know, in summertime there's not that many people. And as I watched all of you come in, it's like, oh, look at that, there's more people. I'm really glad all the kids have gone. It's kind of settled things down a little bit. Psalm 37 helped me through a really difficult time. In fact, it shaped who I am. And it's helped me to understand who I really am. And I want to pray before I get started. Lord, this is your time. This is your time to share your heart for your people. This is your time to interrupt things. This is your time to reinterpret what happens when evil prospers, when a wicked man prospers. This is your time to make yourself known. This is a time for you to share your love with them as you have with me. So we give this time to you. I pray that I'd be a really good pipe and that I would give you everything that I've got and that they would hear you. Amen. As I've been pondering this sermon, one particular day, Lee and I were playing some tennis. And we're playing tennis, and I've been thinking about this sermon for weeks, you guys. Psalm 37 actually has been in my heart for How many years, Tim? 8 years? Yeah, something like 8 years. And so we're playing tennis, and I'll hit the ball, and if I hit the ball like this, and I'm looking where I'm going to place my shot, Lee would win. Every single time. If I keep my eye on the ball, though, and if I would keep my eye on the ball, I'd score every time. Here's what's crazy. Drove me nuts. I knew it. I was getting so frustrated with myself because as I'm playing with Lee, I'd go, eye on the ball, Troy. Eye on the ball. Eye on the ball. Eye on the ball. And I'd swing and I'd be shooting for where I want to put it instead of keeping the eye on the ball. To the point where it's in my head, eye on the ball, eye on the ball, eye on the ball. And I'd swing and I'd cheat. I think, okay, I can, you know, if I just keep my eye on the ball and look at the same time, it'll work. Every time. Lee won. Lee won 6-3. And then the second game, the second set, we played 2-2. All in all, Lee won. There's my humility for the day. But I won too, because I learned a great lesson. In the middle of it, in the middle of that lesson, I actually stopped. And I said, Lee, I got it. I got it. I got the illustration. I got the illustration for what this is going to look like. And so I told him what was going on. He prayed for me. There you go. You got to have it. So focusing on the ball is focusing on God, trusting him, keeping your eye on the ball. You're going to hear me say, eye on the ball, a lot. When you focus on him, you prosper. You'll win. When you focus on where to place the ball, you lose. You're trying to control things. When you lose your sight on the ball, that's when you're fretting. That's when you're worrying. When I focus on winning, I lose. When I focus on him, I win. The theme of trusting the Lord is woven throughout Psalm 37 in times when wicked men prosper. David wrote this psalm towards the end of his life and ponders on his past to see what God has been up to in his life while wrestling with very challenging people. Psalm 37 is written with the first Hebrew word in alphabetical order for each verse for the sake of memorization. I found this psalm really frustrating because I like to look for themes. And this thing bounces back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And what's really cool for me is actually the back and forth is just kind of like a tennis match. It volleys back and forth. Volley one side describes the fate of the just. Volley the other side, it's the fate of the wicked. So when I read this, I want you to listen to that theme, okay? We're going to be doing a volley back and forth. So, service. Do not fret because of those who evil or be envious of those who do wrong. For like the grass, they will soon wither. Like green plants, they will soon die away. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and enjoy safe pasture. Delight. Take delight in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him, and he will do this. He will make your righteous reward shine like the dawn, your vindication like the noonday sun. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when people succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not fret. It only leads to evil, folly. For those who are evil will be destroyed, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. A little while and the wicked will be no more. Though you look for them, they will not be found. Volley. But the meek will inherit the land and enjoy peace and prosperity. Volley. The wicked plot against the righteous and gnash their teeth at him. But the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he knows their day is coming. The wicked draw the sword and bend the bow to bring down the poor and needy, to slay those whose ways are upright, but their swords will pierce their own hearts, and their bows will be broken. Volley. Better the little
that the righteous have than the wealth of many wicked, for the power of the wicked will be broken. But the Lord upholds the righteous. The blameless spend their days under the Lord's care, and their inheritance will endure forever. In times of disaster, they will not wither. In days of famine, they will enjoy plenty. Volley. But the wicked will perish. The Lord's enemies are like the flowers of the field. They will be consumed. They will go up in smoke. The wicked borrow and do not pay, but the righteous give generously. Volley. Those the Lord blesses will inherit the land, but those he curses will be destroyed. The Lord makes firm the steps of the one who delights in him. Though he may stumble, he will not fall. For the Lord upholds him with his hand. I was young and now I am old, yet I have never seen the righteous forsaken or their children begging bread. They are always generous and lend freely. Their children will be a blessing. Turn from evil and do good. Then you will dwell in the land forever, for the Lord loves the just and will not forsake his faithful ones. Volley. Wrongdoers will be completely destroyed, and the offspring of the wicked will perish. Volley. The righteous will inherit the land and dwell in it forever. The mouths of the righteous utter wisdom, and their tongues speak what is just. The law of their Lord is in their hearts. Their feet do not slip. Volley. The wicked lie in wait for the righteous, intent on putting them to death. But the Lord will not leave them in the power of the wicked or let them be condemned when brought to trial. Volley. Hope in the Lord and keep his ways. He will exalt you to inherit the land. When the wicked are destroyed, you will see it. I have seen a wicked and ruthless man, flourishing like the luxuriant native tree. But he soon passed away and was no more. Though I looked for him, he could not be found. Volley. Consider the blameless. Observe the upright. A future awaits those who seek peace. But all sinners will be destroyed. There will be no future for the wicked. And here's the ace shot. The salvation of the righteous comes from the Lord. He is their stronghold in time of trouble. The Lord helps them and delivers them. He delivers them from the wicked and saves them because they take refuge in him. Because they trust him and because they're learning to trust him. The picture, awesome picture. I didn't plan this, by the way, but it helps. I don't know if you noticed at the very beginning when Eric poured the water in, the bubbles and the water actually did mix. It does separate, but it takes time. So I would challenge Eric and say, yeah, actually water and oil mix for a time. The bubbles there, the chaos that's there, but over the course of time, it actually separates. I'm talking about the bubbles today. But I want to stop. Because a friend of mine on Wednesday said to me, Troy, the last thing that this congregation needs is to be told about how they just don't trust him enough. The last thing they need to be told is they should trust him more, do better, work harder. Feel bad because you just don't trust him. I don't think that's the point of this psalm at all. And you know what, if that's how I preach to you today, if that's how I preach to you today, I think I've got my eyes off the ball. Instead, I want to explore this thing called trust. What does it mean to trust him? What does it mean not to fret? David gives us some keys that he received from living a pretty chaotic life. Chaotic when wicked men did prosper. The wicked prosper. And all that is required for evil men to prosper is that men, good men do nothing. So that means that there's some things that we can do. And actually, there's 14. In the psalm, there's 14 ways that David has recommended that we respond Not to feel bad, not to say, oh, we should do more, but there's a response that can occur. Calm down. Do good. Dwell in the land, like dwelling in the house of the Lord forever. Delight in the Lord. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in Him. Be still before the Lord. Wait patiently. That's my favorite. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. I'm not very good at that. Turn from evil. Hope in the Lord. Consider the blameless and observe the upright. What are good people doing? What are they doing? Watch them. Does David realize what he's asking of us, though? The kind of pain that we're actually having to bear? And I think he has. Because all 14 of these things require that we actually do trust in some way or another. We're in the bubbles. When David was away in battle, came back to Ziklag, the city's wiped out. His children are gone. His wives are gone. The wives are gone. The livestock's gone. Everything's gone. David's out fighting God's battle for him. God doesn't take care of business while he's away. Is God trustworthy? All the men that he took down to fight, they want to kill him. David's response is, he goes out into the world, he takes himself out, and he encourages himself in the Lord. He gets built back up again, and he gets some instruction while he's there, and he wins. He wins everyone back. Another time, David trusted his throne and never controlled things to take it. Saul hunted this guy for 10 years, 15 years, I don't know exactly the number of years. And David had Saul's life in his hands. He could have taken Saul's life anytime he wanted to, in I think 3 or 4 places. And he didn't. He didn't grab hold of control. He trusted God with his throne, ultimately the throne that was going to be his. He trusted his kingship to God when Absalom took his throne, actually grabbed hold of it, took control. What's amazing to me is he didn't get bitter. He didn't get angry about this. He trusted in the Lord, and while his son, or sorry, while his army is off chasing Absalom, hunting him down, David's response is, be gentle with my son. Be gentle with him. That's not how most of us treat our enemies or one who's betrayed us. What is it about David that he can do that? David trusted his legacy with Solomon. He wants to build the temple. No, your hands are too full of blood. David actually says, okay, fine. I'm going to set everything up so that my son can build, and then my legacy gets built through him. In a world of instant gratification, where we actually, we see the, I'm going to trip over this thing sooner or later. Excuse me. In a world of gratification where we want instant gratification, David is in a place where he waits patiently. His legacy does live on. In David's story, though, wicked men fail. They do go broke. Saul actually falls on his own sword. They perished. But all of that happened over time. David had to wait and he had to trust. At the same time, his righteousness did shine like the sun. He does inherit the throne, his inheritance. He dwells in the house of the Lord. He enjoys safe pasture, and David was given the desires of his heart. All of that happened over the course of time, 20 years from the time he's anointed to be king to the time he actually gains the throne. David's the only king who actually became a ruler over all of Israel, the only one. And I think this is a reflection of our lives. And yet David's trust was not perfect. He had to grow into it, and so do we. But how? So I have a bunch of what ifs. What if when we are in the middle of chaos, that's when trust counts? What if when we are tested, that's when we find out where we are keeping our eyes set? Are our eyes set on Him or on our own control? What if our fretting doesn't mean that we don't trust, but that we're a work in progress? What if staying calm and doing good and dwelling and trusting are all part of the deliberate plan to build us to a place where we actually do trust Him? That's the bubbles. What if God puts wicked men in front of you to show you how much you don't trust Him, but also maybe how much you do trust Him? What if God is showing you He's got you? He's the one in control. You're not. What if God is accomplishing things in you that He wouldn't be able to accomplish unless something like this happened to you? What if it's during these times that He shows us that only with Him we have what it takes to get through the trial? What if? What if it's in crisis times like these that God proves His love for us? I ask that John 21 be read today, because I'm going to flip things now. And we're going to talk about Peter now. Peter and David are quintessential stumblers, and I love those two men because they help me understand how much of a David or a Peter I am. I've actually been named Peter a number of times, and so I couldn't help myself. I had to come and talk about Peter. Let's enter into his story. Bold and brash and bravado, he goes at Jesus and he says, "Jesus, your plan for saving souls isn't right." He speaks with great confidence about, "I will die for you, Jesus." Okay, arrogance. He falls asleep at Gethsemane when he's asked to watch and pray at those critical moments. He fails. He cuts an ear off. He's in control now. He and the apostles all run away. When wicked men prosper. Jesus gets left alone. The wicked have him. And Peter has done exactly the opposite of what he said he's going to do. He's tried to control things that cannot be controlled. As predicted by Jesus, Peter denies him three times. And then in Luke it says, just as he denied him the third time, the Lord turned and looked at Peter. Right when Peter doesn't have his eyes on him, Jesus turns his eyes on Peter. This is the crucial moment. Because this is the time when Peter finally faces the fact that he doesn't trust him. And in the original language, when it says Peter looks straight at him, it looks straight through him to Peter's heart, to where Peter's really at, to the places where he's failed, to the place where he's not trusting, to the bravado, to all the false things about who Peter really is. What would it be like for you in that moment? You have all these plans, you know what you want to do, but you don't follow through. What would it be like for you? Peter's taken his eyes off the ball, and he knows it, and he runs out weeping. Weeping over his brokenness. Finally. Finally. Jesus dies. The wicked have succeeded in their schemes. But 3 days later, everything changes. Jesus tells Mary to tell the apostles and Peter that he is risen. Why do you think the word says, "and Peter"? This is important to Peter. Jesus knows him. He knows Peter needs to know that everything that he has sunk his trust into was right. He also tells her to tell them to go to Galilee. Peter hears and he runs to the tomb and he's bewildered to find there's the linens, no Jesus. Now the scriptures say that Jesus appears to Peter one-on-one on that particular day. It doesn't say what actually happened, but this is what I believe, and I've read a number of commentaries that would agree with that, or maybe I agree with them. Or anyway, I believe that what happened on that particular day, Jesus forgave Peter. Because later in John 21, when Peter sees Jesus, he jumps out of the boat and he goes running straight for him. And if you're not forgiven, I don't think you could do it. I think if he didn't feel like he was forgiven, he would have stayed in the boat and hidden. But he didn't. So that's my supposition. You guys can go and study that for yourselves. Then Jesus appears to the 11 and speaks to their lack of trust and opens their minds to see, to put their eyes back on the ball again. He gives them the Holy Spirit, and they're encouraged to go and make disciples. I think Peter's reminded that he's the rock during this time. And then they wait. My favorite. And they go to Galilee, as Jesus had instructed. And afterward, Jesus sets the stage to walk Peter through how to trust again in John 21. So I want to set the stage here a little bit. These guys are about to, Peter's hanging out with some of his fishermen buddies. You know that James and John and Peter are there, Didymus, who's Thomas, and a number of other apostles. But there's, looks like at least three fishermen are there. And they're hanging out, doing nothing. They're not making disciples. They've been told to wait. Peter's the rock. He's the leader. He's supposed to be establishing the church. They're doing nothing. What do you think's going on in Peter's head? I knew I was going to trip sooner or later. What do you think's going on in Peter's head? Nothing's going on. Maybe my lack of trust has caused him to not set me up to lead. I think doubt creeps in. I think what's happened here is doubt has creeped in. Because he says, well, let's just go fishing. Because you know what? I, Simon, I know fishing. I'm a good fisherman. I've been doing fishing for a long, long time. I'm not called to do this, but I know fishing, so I'll go do that. Let's go fishing, boys. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, the two fishermen, and two other disciples were together. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them. And they said, well, we'll go with you because we don't know what we're supposed to do either. So they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. So back to this stage. This is Peter's boat. When they go back to Galilee, it's either Peter's boat or James and John's. So they're right back in the same spot where they first met him, where they first said yes to him. This scripture is all about flashback to the past. Jesus says, come follow me here. Peter, of course I'll follow you. You know, I know what it's like to be Peter. I know what it's like to fret over things. I know what it's like to feel like I'm losing my job. Feel like I've lost, I know what it feels like to feel like I've lost some of my family members. I've lost more than 10 best friends. I've lost 2 outstanding career opportunities. I've lost family members. I've lost ministry opportunities that have lit my heart up. And it's broken me. I've done some dying. But you know, I'm a pretty good engineer. Now, Tim and Gary might tell you something differently, but permit me a little bit of that. Because you know, a good engineer can control a lot of things. I'd be able to rearrange my life. I won't be surprised and I won't get hurt. It won't cost so much. He won't be able to take so much away from me. And I won't have to trust him so much then. Yeah, I've taken my eyes off the ball. But you know what? He loves me too much to leave me there. Way too much. I believe when I was in some of these places, and maybe you would say today, he's got me exactly where he wants me. And he interrupts everything just at the right time. And in this story, Jesus has Peter right where he wants him. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, "Friends, have you got any fish?" "No," they answered. Just like the very first time. He said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some." When they did, they were unable to haul in the net. Excuse me. Because of the large number of fish. Over the right side of the boat. Just like the first time. Massive amount of fish, just like the first time. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the Lord." As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It's the Lord," he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire burning. Coals there with fish on it and some bread. A fire. Coals. Been there for a while. It's been burning for a time. Another flashback. The last time Peter saw Jesus before, when he denied him, what was he doing? There it is again. I mean, The flashbacks that are hitting Peter over and over and over again speak exactly to Peter. Do you remember? Do you remember? Do you remember? Do you remember? Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish you have just caught. So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat and dragged the net ashore. Pretty strong guy to be able to pull 153 fish in. It was full of large fish, but even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples dared to ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread, and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. Bread and fish. Breaking it, sharing it, multiplying it. He had enough for all 8 or 9 of them there. Just like the past. When he fed the 5,000, when he fed the 3,000. Notice how many times Jesus has to do this with Peter. You know, most of us kind of catch the wind of something after 2-3 times. I don't know, maybe it's, I know I probably need about the same number. But you guys, of course, would only need 3, right? I look at the story and I see how Jesus sets Peter up. And it's to show Peter how he's been true to his word and accurate in his predictions. I want you to set your feet into Peter's shoes now. Imagine this has all happened to you. You clearly don't trust him, or you would be going out making disciples. You've fallen back into your old story and your old identity. He's Simon. He's not Peter. He's Simon the fisherman, not Peter the rock. And you sit around the fire having a meal and nothing is being said. It's silent. So how long does it take to have a meal? 10 minutes? 15 minutes? Nothing. Silence. Waiting. 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 What would he say to you? What's going to happen? What would you be thinking about? Hey, Peter. Let's go for a walk. Oh. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? First thing, do you see that Jesus is speaking to Simon, not Peter? Do you notice that? Simon, son of John. Simon, the fisherman. You've forgotten who you really are. Do you love me? Simon, do you love me enough to die for me? Because that's what he's asking. Do you trust me? I love you like a... You know that I love you, Lord. Like a brother. Obviously, not enough. Not enough to die for you. I've said that I love you more than all the rest of these, but that's not true. That's not true. I don't trust you. My actions have shown that I don't trust you, but I'm here because I do trust you too. Feed my lambs. Simon, feed my lambs. Peter, feed my lambs, actually. Peter, go feed my lambs. Take care of my kids. Because you know what? I know that you know this now. I know that you know that you're not trustworthy. I know that you understand this. I'm going to trust you with my kids. Do you love me enough to die for me, Simon? He answered, yes, Lord. You know that I love you. Like a brother. Not enough to die for you. Jesus says, take care of my sheep. Simon, I know that you don't trust me. And I know you'll try again. I know that you're growing in trust with me now. I'm going to trust you not only with my kids, but also with my adult kids. The third time, he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Do you love me enough to die for me, Simon? When I am asked something three times, the third time I hear it, it means that he's thinking that I'm not paying attention. Or you're not, you know, if you were to ask me a question three times in a row, exactly the same one, the third time, it's because you don't think that I'm paying attention. But three times denied, three times restored. You know, I would even get offended. Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. You know it, Lord. You know me. All of me, inside and out. All my failures, all my worry, all my fretting, my controlling nature, everything. You know it all. I haven't trusted you. I want to trust you. It's why I'm here right now. I'm going to keep my eyes on you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. Feed them all. Take care of all of them. Be the good shepherd. Follow me. Be a good shepherd as I have been the good shepherd. Very truly, I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, follow me. Just like the first time. Right back there again. Except this time, Jesus predicts how Peter's going to die. And Peter actually does die for him, doesn't he? The word stretched out is stretched out on the cross. Tradition says that Peter died a crucifixion death, upside down, because he didn't want to be crucified in the same way as Jesus. Peter's got his eyes on the ball now. And you know this because in Acts 2, all heaven breaks loose, Pentecost occurs, all kinds of stuff's going on, but there's mockery and there's persecution going on, and Peter steps up. Says, hang on a sec. Hang on a sec. I know what's going on here. I know what's going on. And he preaches a sermon, Billy Graham kind of sermon. 3,000 men give their lives to Christ, so the tradition is that children and women, probably 10,000. That's a good sermon. God's restoring my trust, and I am growing in trust. I have seen wicked men fade away, and I have not seen them again. I am connecting with my sons at a heart level that I've never done before. He's restoring my marriage, and he's restored my marriage. The friendships that I have cultivated are deeper than ever before. I've learned how to trust the trustworthy ones. Ministry is setting my heart on fire again. The fact that I'm actually standing up here, and believe me, I've been set on fire this week. Preparing the sermon has made me weep many times this past week, you guys. It's been awesome. I'm prospering in my work greater than ever before. God is prospering my work. And yet I do not completely trust it. Yet I'm growing in trust. So I'm going to finish with a final story. Christine and I went to Mexico a number of years ago, and we were in an all-inclusive resort. And those of you who have been to an all-inclusive resort, you can drink and eat and party and do whatever you want for days on end. And about halfway through that week that we were there, I just felt dirty. I felt I've been in the world for too long. I've been grabbing hold of what the world has for me, and I had to get out of there. So I grabbed a kayak and I headed out into the bay of Puerto Vallarta, and I'm paddling, and I feel like I'm just shedding things and shedding things and shedding things. And finally, I'm getting into that place where I feel like I actually can commune, and maybe I'm not nearly as messy as I thought I was, and I'm Peter. I feel like I've kind of put some things behind me, and I say, you know, Lord, I'm all by myself right now. I'm at least a mile offshore. What do you think? How about I try walking on water? I actually tried. I did. Whoosh! And I got back up on the kayak, and I just, I guess not today, huh? Too much of a mess. And God says, no, not too much of a mess. I'll let you walk on water when you won't tell anybody else. Checkmate! He has a sense of humor, you guys. He really does. And so I turn my kayak around and I start to go back, and you know what? The old doubt comes right back on me. It really did. Okay, I didn't get that. I shed some more and I go, I'm Peter, you guys. Okay, well, you know, Lord, I didn't get to have that, but how about some dolphins? Because it's the delight of my heart to see some dolphins in the wild. I'd only seen dolphins in the wild one other time by this time. And I love them. There's a day I want to, I have a dream yet to be able to go windsurfing with them. Just ride with them. That'd be awesome. And I'm paddling and I'm looking around. I'm looking for them because I've heard that there's some around. Nothing. paddling, getting closer and closer to shore, looking around, nothing, nothing. A couple hundred yards off. Nothing. Too much of a mess, huh, Lord? Too broken. And I stop looking, and I set my eyes on the shore, and I start paddling toward the shore. What was that? He showed up. I just booted it as hard as I could to go over there. 7 dolphins for about 20 minutes. I got to just dance with my kayak. They went away, and I turned and I went for home. I'm wrecked. Because the moment I stopped looking for him, the moment I turned my eyes away from him, the moment I actually faced the fact that I don't trust him, I don't trust him with the fact that I've got a mess going on inside. I don't trust him. I don't trust him. I don't trust him. That's when he shows up. That's when he showed up. Just when I needed it the most. You know what I said to myself as I was going back to shore? Oh, he loves me! I wept. I was wrecked. It was awesome. Because he loves me. And because he loves me, I can trust him. I gave up on his goodness for me when I went for the shore. I took my eyes off the ball, you guys. I did. And he showed up when I finally admitted that I didn't trust him. I have a challenge for you. This coming week, I would ask that each of you go out to the beach. We're in the Okanagan, man. Go for a walk. Have a walk with him. What would Jesus say to you along the beach? Do you love me, Sean? Do you love me, Christine? What would he say to you? Those 14 things that I shared with you, those keys that I think David put together, one of those 14 you really wrestle with. There's a key in there for you. Which one of those 14? I would challenge you to go back and read Psalm 37. Look for those action words. Commit your ways. Dwell in the land. Trust in him. Which one's yours? Which one is the one that you go, I don't like that one? I think you guys have figured out mine. Park on that. Because there's something there for you that you don't trust Jesus about. And when you let him have that, it changes everything. I think he'll show up for you. I've done this. I actually have done this. I've actually gone out to the beach with Christine in Florida. The words he gave me were, encourage my people. Plant seeds with my people. And know the words so you can do those other two things. Well, I just finished doing this today. To preach is to encourage people. To plant seeds in your brains. And to know the word so that I could actually do this well. I'll tell you, when that happened for me, I got wrecked again. Guess what happened? Right after. Remember, we're at the ocean. What happened? It's the only other time I've ever seen dolphins in the wild. 3 of them showed up and danced in front of me. It was awesome. May you go and may you receive a word that God will trust you, cause you to trust him so much more. Lord, thank you for this opportunity to share who you are, who you really are, that you are the God of chaos. You are the God of interrupting things when we've got it wrong about you. You are the God who is trustworthy. You are the God You are the only one who is trustworthy enough that we can actually come to a place when no one else we can trust, nothing else we can trust. You are the only one that is trustworthy enough to take us from the place where we were to where we will be. I pray, Lord, this week that as some of these folks, hopefully all of them, take up the challenge to come to know you, and I pray that you would shout out loud to them how much you love them. In Jesus' name, amen.